Hello, welcome to Living the Present Moment Study Group. Hello to everyone on the call. Today is Friday, May 5th, 2017. I'm Dr. Joel Ying. The website for this blog, newsletter, courses, and the online study group is livingthepresentmoment.com. You can find updates there. You can also get on the email list. You can follow on Facebook. The study group is a place to explore topics together. I'm always looking for feedback on new topics, new guests, new things to do. So visit me there at livingthepresentmoment.com. And I want to say hello out there to all the people live on the call as well as those who will be listening later. Today we're going to have an interview format, and our topic is building a vocal community. Right now, I think we have a couple people on are muted, and I'll unmute you for the Q&A part, but wanted to introduce my guest today, Isai Barnwell. I'm really happy to have you on the call. Just check
Thank
that you're
you.
There.
I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. For everyone out there, I want to say that I met you first at Esalen Institute while you were teaching a workshop, Building a Vocal Community. I was in a different workshop. I was like, oh, I got to take that workshop. So it only took me 3 years, but I did manage to take the workshop at Omega, and I recently watched your TED Talk as well. And so one of the things that fascinates me when I went to that workshop was just how I learned about the oral tradition of singing, and you brought it in from the African chants over to the African-American spirituals, into gospel, into songs, the civil rights movement, and then talked about how organized the movement was around song and how song really united people. And for me, just being in that workshop, not only do you teach history, but you also have us sing together. And I would say to most people, I don't sing. And I don't. I had a friend who took your workshop, and she said, I learned that I am a codependent singer.
Hey, okay.
But it's great. In a chorus environment, you divided us into, and we just kind of divided ourselves. You said, tenors go over there. Bass people go over there. I didn't know what I was, but I made something up. And then alto, sopranos, you taught us all the different parts, and we sang together in harmony. You brought us together at the end after, you know, training us. And one of the highlights for me was watching you. You taught us some songs to sing to the entire retreat center later on. We invited the audience, and then you had us sing. And then you took the whole audience from this retreat center, and I don't know, there were maybe 300 people there. You divided us all up, and you taught us in that moment, and it was just amazing to watch you build a vocal community. You know, you built a choir, built community right there on the spot, and everyone was just enjoy singing. So,
people really do get a kick out of it, and everybody sounds so good.
They do. It's amazing how voices blend and harmonize and sound together. And for everyone else out there, I want to say I was reading on your website, which is ymbarnwell.com for those who want to look you up or just Google you. But I think it's so fascinating how you had so many years as a speech pathologist and then left that career to enter a whole new career and joined Sweet Honey in the Rock, which is an African-American female a cappella group. And for 34 years did that. And you're a composer, a singer, workshop leader, as I said. You've written children's books. I could go on. But I just want to say that I'm just inspired by you and wanted to just start with anything you want to say, but really, how did you come to this workshop, to actually formulating it?
You know, I did study speech pathology in my advanced degrees are in speech path and public health, and you know, life happens. And one of the things that happened was that I went to a church. I wound up joining the Unitarian Church, which I kind of liked the openness of the theology, the openness and the inclusiveness at the same time. And they had a fabulous choir. It was the upstairs choir, you know, the one that sings in the back and you just sit and look forward and listen to the music. And I joined that choir, and there were only 3 black people in the choir. And there were lots of black folks sitting in the congregation, and I couldn't figure out, you know, why they weren't part of this choir as well. And when I started to ask about it, the most common response was, well, you have to read music in order to sing in that choir. Uh-huh. And I said, well, you know, we could start a choir where that wasn't necessary. And I didn't know what I was talking about. I just felt like it was true. So I called a rehearsal, and but my brain, something in my brain clicked on. And I don't remember the first songs that we sang, but I had all the arrangements of it in my head. I heard it. And I just said, well, you know, this group here, try this, 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 this. And before you know it, we had a group of people who were singing in harmony together. And, you know, it was like that was it. That was the beginning of this choir that is now over 40 years old. And more people came, and it just was really a beautiful experience. As a result of starting the choir, the choir was singing one Sunday. I sang a solo. I was just the divine diva doing everything that Sunday, kind of out of my mind. But Bernice Johnson Regan, who was the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, happened to be in the congregation. Oh, yes, I was signing. I was using sign language to interpret for a friend of mine who was hearing impaired. And she came up to me afterwards, and she said, you know, Sweet Honey is having auditions, and will you come? And I thought, whoa, yes. But I never thought that I would get in, because I never thought of myself as a singer, oddly enough. And wow. So I went, and the rehearsal was the audition was a whole month, coming every night for about 3 hours and just singing. No music involved, meaning no written music was involved. Someone would sing, the rest of the group would sing, and I, you know, had the opportunity to either find my way into a part that was missing, or Bernice would say, well, sing this. And I would do that, and the rest of the group would be singing their parts. And at the end of the month, I was selected. There was one other woman who was auditioning at the same time, so I felt quite fortunate. But that was the beginning of my moving from, you know, teaching in the dental school at Howard and being concerned about public health issues and that to being consumed really by music and wanting to share that with other people. So I think the choir at All Souls Church Unitarian in D.C., the Jubilee Singers, was the beginning of that for me.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. And for people who are going to be listening later who don't know about Sweet Honey, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. Sweet Honey in the Rock is an a cappella ensemble of 4 or 5 black women. The group started in 1973. I came in 1979. And the group sings traditional African-American music. We sing composed music, meaning contemporary music that either one of the members of the group has written or something that we've liked that someone else is singing, and then we create our own arrangements. But there are 5 or 4 singers in the group. usually, and we've traveled all over the world. Sweet Honey has a large number of recordings, and we were the first concert at the Obama White House. And until the present day, it was totally a cappella, I think, because I left in 2013 and was the lowest voice in the group. The group is now actually adding a bass player that works with them on some of the material and is moving in a slightly different direction, I think. But the group has been around for quite a long time, has had wide audiences all over the country and in other countries as well.
Wow. And I got to see you perform, and one of my favorite things was not just hearing the music, but watching the sign language interpreting going on as well.
Yeah. I say we, because I still feel like I'm a part of the group even though I'm retired. I think we're the only group in the United States, and that might mean the world, that has had a sign language interpreter as part of the ensemble for almost as many years as it's existed. Shirley Childress Saxton, who was the sign language interpreter that I brought into the group in 1980, I think, recently passed. And so now there is another woman who has stepped into her place. And so that's been consistent almost since the beginning.
Wow.
And so we have, the group has had a very, very large deaf following, and we've had some interesting experiences. We went to Japan, and they knew that we had a sign language interpreter, and even though people might not understand her, she was going to be part of our ensemble. And so they gave us a English-speaking interpreter, and they gave us a Japanese sign language interpreter. So there were four languages. Yeah, there were four languages on the stage. There was English, there was American Sign Language, there was Japanese, and Japanese Sign Language. It was amazing.
Oh, wow. Wow. I'm also intrigued by what you said, that you, you know, that I think it is true. I do think of choirs as, oh, I have to read music and I have to be able to sing my part.
Sing your part, follow the conductor, and yes.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on, and I realized that as I was in your class, since you do it from an oral tradition, you said, you will not write anything down. I will not give you words. You will hear it and sing it back to me. And so we did that. That's what you said to do.
It's amazing, right, that it happened,
amazing.
Right? Yeah.
Yes, yes. It awakens another part of the brain, and it really, I do storytelling, which opened my voice in one way, but the singing opened my voice in a completely different way, and that, you know, my house, which is my best audience, loves to hear me sing and tell stories.
It's wonderful.
But now I go to places with my voice that I would not have gone before, and I just for fun, you know?
Right. And it's really nice when other people are singing with you. You know, there's a kind of camaraderie. People are unsure at first and, you know, maybe have never sung with other people. And there is, you know, when I do a community sing, there is joy, amazing joy at the end of it. You know, people always stand up and they applaud. And I don't even know if they realize they're applauding for themselves because they did something amazing. You know?
It is amazing.
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is. And I think, you know, and you might have questions about this later, but people are physically and mentally impacted by the power of sound. And when you are part of that phenomena, it's just overwhelming sometimes, you know, that you, with some people that you may not ever have met before, have had an experience that has produced something so beautiful, so energizing, et cetera. Mm. So, you know, it's a wonderful thing that happens.
Yeah, I loved, you talk about that a lot in your TED Talk that everyone can find online on YouTube. I say Google your name and TED Talk. But I love one of the things you said, our voices activate every cell in our bodies, and just that vibration is healing. And then just that, like you said, that feeling of being a part of something so beautiful. It's really,
mm-hmm. And bigger than you, you know?
Yes.
And I think that's true even if you're singing a solo and someone is listening, it's bigger than you. Or even if you're singing in a room and you feel the response of the environment, the room that you're in, you know, you say, wow, I love singing in the bathroom. Okay. You know, because it's so reverberant. And each room has its own personality. And so your voice moves into that space and then comes back and sort of, you know, massages from the outside all of the cells in your body. It's just, it's really, singing is an amazing, phenomenal thing.
Mm. I also like the theme of your TED Talk of accessing the power of our voices together. I remember in the workshop said, when people sing together, other people will stop to listen. It's just built into us, wired in. I remember someone in the workshop also said that they, we were talking about the songs of the Civil Rights Movement. She led us through some of those beautiful songs. But she said she went to a rally and they didn't have any songs in her group, and she found out she went to the other side because they had someone playing the guitar and singing songs.
I've been listening. I don't go to rallies, but I do listen. I turn them on. I hear them on the radio, and I'll listen to the whole thing. And, you know, a year or so ago, there was a huge rally. Well, even the women's rally that we had right after the election, you know, and the cameras are constantly panning the group, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't hear any songs. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, there are these thousands of women who have come together, and I'm sure there's a choir somewhere that is singing a choir song, if you know what I mean. They've learned all the parts, they have a director, and they are standing together, and they are singing, and everybody is listening. But that's not the same as getting everyone around you to participate in the singing. If you, you know, if you can imagine that many thousand people all singing together, you know how extraordinary that would have been. There's an amazing film. I'm trying to think of the title of it, but it's really the story of the Estonian Revolution, and they call it the Singing Revolution. The whole country sang, and the power of that was that it changed everything, politically, spiritually, everything, and. You know, during the Civil Rights Movement, I think people heard more singing than anything else. Anyone who was out demonstrating or marching or on their way to jail, you know, everybody in that context would sing. And if you listen to some of the people who were deeply involved, you know, I used to talk to Bernice all the time, who was one of the original SNCC Freedom Singers, and they would lead people in songs. And, you know, she would say the police were probably more afraid than they were, particularly if they were coming up on a group. For example, the people who crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, the police didn't know at the bottom of the bridge, the police didn't know how many people were coming. There was no way for them to know, but they were all singing, and it must have been huge. And so my sense is that the police were probably more fearful than the marchers were because the sound that they were creating was so big. That sound goes out in front of you and announces who you are. And, you know, you have to stop and think, what is a police officer thinking when they have raised a billy club and all you are doing is standing and singing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what's the justification for using the club if all you are doing is singing? And so, you know, to kind of break through a song barrier, you have to really have some kind of intent, which is not good, which is not positive, because nothing really is being done that is illegal if you are simply standing and singing. So it really, you know, I really want young people to understand how powerful it is when we stand and sing together. And I want them to understand that music has evolved to a point where we rarely hear singers singing together, even on the radio. That hip-hop has moved into a direction where there aren't even any backup singers anymore.
Wow.
So you have that one lone person, you know, who is singing, rapping, whatever, and that's it. Well, you know, that doesn't help at a rally. It just doesn't help. It doesn't help for, you know, 1,000 people or more to just stand and listen. What really galvanizes people is for them to all be brought into the moment in the song.
Mm.
And that's the reason I try to and want to speak with, you know, millennials to say, hey, you know, there is something that we did. And I know it might sound old and fuddy-duddy, but it works. And it's fun. And it is a nonviolent way of taking care of yourself, and that is to sing together. And so I try, you know, to get people to understand the excitement of singing together. And not necessarily in harmony the way we do in the workshop, but just the fact of singing together and knowing how to raise a song, knowing how to lead a song, knowing how to be the voice of the song, so that if you have something that says, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, you know, you can say, ain't gonna let the police turn me around, ain't gonna let injustice turn me around, ain't gonna let, you know, you put in the words that are relevant for the circumstances that you find yourself in. And that gives you power. Because you become the voice of the masses. And, again, everybody can participate.
I love that. I love when you talked about the history of the songs of the Civil Rights Movement, that it was really, you know, it was recognized that it was something that galvanized the community, and it was an organized part of the movement. It wasn't, let's go out and just sing. It was, there were meetings, there were agreements on what you believe in, that you're going to sing about. And it was an organized part of the movement to sing together and to learn these songs.
Yes. It's important, and I think, you know, now because of technology, you know, we just show up. And we show up in large numbers. Nobody knows what's going to happen. We just show up. And in the civil rights movement, you know, people would get together. It's like, why? What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Are you willing to be arrested for this action that we're going to do? Where we're going to stand and sing about what the issues are. You know, you would have instructions like take your driver's license, you know, or your school ID and bring some bus money so you can get back home if you're not arrested. You know, but you don't need to carry X's. So, you know, it was just common sense. And then what are the issues? Because anybody could be chosen to say, why are you here? Well, I'm here because, you know. And so people would be educated about what the issues were, about what the options were, about what the threats might be, and how to take care of yourself. They would have role playing, you know, and they would role play a police officer beating someone with a billy club. You know, how do you cover your head? How do you protect your body? But we just show up now, you know. We don't get together. We don't agree on what the most important issues are. We don't discuss them to be sure that people understand what the real issues are. And so, or to learn the songs, you know. But the other aspect of the songs is that many of them were call and response. So you didn't have to really know all the words. Once you heard the response, you would know what to do. Even deeper than that, the music of the civil rights movement really was an offshoot of the black church. And, you know, in the black church, everybody sings. Whether you have a hymnal or not, you are expected to sing. There are usually about four choirs in a black church because the seniors have to have their choir where they sing the old music. And then, you know, there is the concert kind of choir. They sing the anthems. And then there's, you know, the young adult choir who sings, you know, all the most contemporary kind of stuff. And then the little cherub choirs, you know. Jesus wants me for an angel. You know, that, that kind of thing. But, they, but there's all of this music, you know, and the songs from the civil rights movement, the initial songs from the civil rights movement came right out of the church. So everybody knew those songs. They didn't have to learn those songs. All they had to do was agree on the issues. And if we change the words, what words are we going to put in? What are we looking for? What are we demanding? Put those words in that song. And so, you know, it was generic to the black community. It was not generic to the Occupy movement. There were no songs for Occupy. Black people were not a major force in the Occupy movement. There was no singing. And, you know, so as movements change, the people who sort of dominate the organizing of it and dominate in the numbers who participate, it reflects that. So for me, when you hear a movement with no song, it's going to be a white movement. You might have some famous people who come and sing at you or for you, but they don't include everybody. So it's like a little mini concert if you're a reward for showing up, you know?
Yeah, I was watching your TED Talk, which I encourage everyone to do because every time I watch it, I sing along. And I leave feeling. I think you sing This Little Light of Mine. And what else do you say? I forgot the other song.
Glory,
but anyway.
Hallelujah.
Oh, yes. Glory, glory, hallelujah. In two-part harmony. And it's beautiful. So I sing it every time I listen. But also, I came away with that greater message of exactly what you just said, that song and singing has been moved to entertainment rather than we do or do together. It's something we go and listen to. It's just entertainment, and it's something that professionals do or the people who know how to do it do. But everybody can sing, and what brought this home as well as I was reading about Jamaican music for a story I was going to write, or I'm still writing, and I came across a Jamaican songs that were called Mentos. Now, today, a lot of those songs are sold as Calypso, which is actually mm-hmm. from that, and it's all of the Caribbean. But when I looked at the Mentos were came from work songs. Mm. So when the government had people hired and they brought them in to dig a ditch, they would hire one person to sing the song, and mm-hmm. it was a call and response song. And I thought it was fun that I learned that the Harry Belafonte song comes from one of those Mentos, the Deo, the banana mm-hmm. boat song.
Right.
So, I realized that singing, you know, was part of how we came together. You know, it kept the rhythm of the workers, it kept things going. But it was
exactly.
It, you know, from not just how we worship, but into our daily life and every other place, singing together.
Well, you know, yeah, and part of that has to do with worldview, because those people who were in the Caribbean, you know, also came from Africa,
mm-hmm.
and there's no separation in African culture between sacred and secular. Everything is sacred.
Mm.
Life is sacred. And we sing not only to maintain a communication with, you know, God and all of the entities between us and God, but we sing to maintain the relationship that we have with each other. And you know, I just talked with a couple of people recently about the nature of spirituals. And I was saying to them, I don't really know who first used the term spirituals to describe African music in the New World, and particularly those songs that were created that relate to the sacred, to people in the Bible, et cetera. I don't know when that term was first applied, but I think that the person or persons who first agreed to it didn't understand that the music that was being created was not just for worship. It was that life was sacred, work was sacred, so how best, even if you don't like the fact that you're working, you are working and you must do it in a certain way. You must do it together. In order to do it together, someone helps you keep the rhythm, et cetera. It's the way you teach children how to, you know, put on their clothes, how to bake bread, how to clean the house. All of those things are, from an African worldview, sacred. And so, you know, and the music is attached to every area of life activity. That is not necessarily the case coming out of a Eurocentric worldview, where music is for pleasure. It creates beauty. It is something that you listen to or observe, and rarely do you participate in it. And so it's a whole different, you know, it's created for a whole different reason. And so when, you know, it depends on who's looking at this,
okay.
How it gets interpreted.
Wow. You know, I'd love for you to tell us, I know it's part of your campaign as well, but I remember you talking about it in the workshop, and also I heard an interview with Krista Tippett and Vincent Harding. You'll never hear Kumbaya the same again is the name of that piece. And I was wondering if you could tell us the story of Kumbaya.
Yeah. And I use the Vincent Harding story as an example. You know, very often today we hear people and say, oh, you know, it was really a kumbaya moment. We were all together and everything was so nice. And I shudder every time I hear that, because that's not what the song is. That's not what the song is about. Kumbaya, for those of you who are not familiar, is Gullah. Gullah is a language that slaves created out of the language of Angola, where many were brought to South Carolina, and English and whatever other mixture was there, and remnants of the Gullah language still remain. Kumbaya means come by here, and it does not mean so we can have a good time. It means we are in trouble, and we are invoking. It's an invocation that invites God to come and see about us. So one of the examples that I used was one that was given or told by Vincent Harding about 1965, when hundreds of white students went from the North, were trained how to be effective civil rights workers, and came together in Mississippi. And they were there for a very short time, and then realized that three of these workers who had gone off to do whatever their mission was had not returned. They did not return, and after the third day, and their bodies were discovered, the group began to realize that all three had been murdered. I'm talking now about Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, their deaths in Mississippi. And so this grouping of hundreds of mostly white students, you know, who had been told that they needed to talk with their parents and other relatives because this was a dangerous journey to begin with because of the racism, they were told to call their parents and let them know that they were okay. And but before they did that, they had a decision to make, which was, were they going to stay or were they going to leave? And no matter what the decision, it was going to be okay. They were not going to advise people to stay beyond their comfort level. And so the students were having a conversation among themselves. They were meditating on what had happened. And Vincent Harding came across a field and began to hear this song, which was Kumbaya. And he knew that these students knew the meaning of this song, whether they'd ever been told it or not. But I think a lot of us learned it in Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts, and we think it's, you know, it's so nice to sit around the fire and sing Kumbaya, my Lord, Kumbaya, and not have any sense of the history of the song. Clearly, it's not, quote unquote, the King's English, so it has some other derivation, and it may have behind it a meaning that if you're not part of the culture, you don't understand. So I ask people to be allies with me in helping others to understand that Kumbaya is a very sacred song. The language is remnant of Africa, but the intent of the song is to ask God to come, because God is needed in whatever the situation is.
Would you sing a verse for us?
Sure, I'll sing it two ways for you. I think I have to back up from the phone, I'm not sure.
Please do. Powerful singing going on here.
Kumbaya,
Yeah.
Hmm. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
And I love just that what's different is just the intent. If you hold a strong intent of invocation, you know, it's an invocation.
Totally.
Calling God in, that changes how you sing the song and it changes how it feels in your body.
Yes, it does. Totally. Totally.
I have a guest on the call. I'm going to unmute her and see if she has any questions. Let's see.
Okay.
Hello? Mary Lou?
I'm here. Uh-huh.
Hi. Thank you for joining on the call. Do you have any? Do you have any questions or comments?
I find it all fascinating and how I never thought before how large a role music and song played in social movements, such as the civil rights movement. And now that it was pointed out to me, it seems, you know, it seems, of course, how could I not have noticed? But I just didn't think of it. I didn't realize its importance in those movements. Yet I realized in thinking back, yet that music was a great part of it. That song was a big part of effectiveness. And even I was thinking of the Civil War. Music in the Civil War was a great part of that conflict. It was a great part of the emotion and the power of the movement in rallying people to the cause. So music has a great emotional impact, there's no doubt about it. It's just that you don't realize it. It seems so, just doesn't seem political yet. It can be very, very moving, very political, very emotionally effective in rallying people to a cause.
Can I impose on that just a little bit? I think if you think about it, almost every occupation had a body of songs. There are coal mining songs, there are steel worker songs, there are sea shanties, there are songs for every occupation when we were organized in that way. You understand what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And the research that I did for my public health degree looked at the songs of coal miners.
Mm.
And what I want, and steel workers, what I wanted to know was, to what degree did the songs accurately talk about the impact of working in the mills, in the mines? Did they talk about, you know, how long it took for them to begin to show symptoms of coal dust, et cetera? What other kinds of injuries might have been talked about in the songs? So I looked at 150 songs. And I can, you know, go back into that research, but I can tell you that there were songs that talked about how long it took. You know, I started working in the mines, and 3 months later I started coughing, and then I couldn't stop coughing, and or I would leave work on Friday, and things would get better, and then I'd go back to work on Monday, okay? And I looked at the difference between the coal miners and textile workers, because one were mostly men and textile workers were mostly women. And I went through a huge number of songs, and they described the impact of their diseases, the onset of their diseases, the course of the diseases, very accurately. But we would think, you know, oh, that one song about the explosion and the so-and-so, yeah, yeah, okay, everybody knows about that. Except when you start putting together, oh, the explosion of 19 so-and-so, oh, the explosion of so-and-so and so-and-so, oh. And who would think that if you were working with fabrics and textiles, that there would be a hazard? Well, one song talks about boredom and just daydreaming and getting a needle in the finger. Okay? And so who thinks about boredom as a hazard? But these songs tell you. So, you know, black people are not the only people who write songs, and I don't ever intend to imply that. We use songs in different ways. But if you look at the songs that people write or wrote, there are large numbers of songs that give you intense, intimate details about their lives. And it's no different today. It's just that today is today, and we don't know those people even existed.
So it's
almost every occupation that you could look at, say before 1955, 1960, you will find songs that tell you about history.
So every historical movement, every social condition, and every social movement would have its songs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Solidarity forever.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious the link between, I've been exploring storytelling, but not really the history, the link between storytelling and song. Because those are people telling their stories through song, and I was wondering.
Absolutely,
why did they choose that medium, and when would they choose, you know, another medium? Very interesting.
See, that is something that I've not looked at, but I think somebody could or should look at. When was it more appropriate, you know, for a person to create a song than to tell a story? Go ahead.
I just want to say, there are songs that are stories. Ballads are stories set to music,
Yes, of course. Exactly. That's in large part what songs are. They're stories. And they're stories that you can sing to yourself, tell to yourself. But, you know, if you tell a story verbally to yourself, people think you're a little off. So it's nice to have, it's kind of nice to have somebody else to talk to if you're going to tell a story, you know. And I think that's one of the differences. Another difference is that having a melody to a story helps you to remember. So I think those are some of the differences.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I can see now how the two styles weave together. That there's just different ways of telling your story.
Mm-hmm.
Song is obviously one that can really... just as you said throughout this call, it unites us and brings us together and makes things memorable and stokes the emotions and really a powerful medium.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think telling a story is a singular event. You know, one person tells the story unless they devise a way to involve the listener. But mostly it's told by one person.
Yeah.
If it's more than one person, it becomes, you know, a different kind of an event, a theatrical event or whatever. But you can sing a song, you know, by yourself. And it doesn't require a listener.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about storytelling, and when we bring it down to the denominator of storytelling for kids, it must involve the listener, and it just changes, and often songs and interactive, you know, interactiveness has to come into it. So it's funny how that wisdom comes in to that place as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I love what you just talked about, how people had their personal stories moved into songs that they would sing, and just the coal miners talking about the coal miner diseases, disease of exposure. In this country, a lot of the personal storytelling has become very popular. And when you go back to Europe, they don't think of that as real storytelling. They think of real storytelling as the myths and the folk tales and the legends, whether they're new or old, but that they can identify sort of that universal message much easier.
Interesting. So
think of as storytelling. Over here, we think of personal stories, and we think I identify myself with that person in the story, and then get the universal message. There, it's my personal story goes into the universal, comes out to influence me, make it back.
Interesting.
A song has a whole different place in that, in the same way. Wow.
Yeah.
What would you...
Go ahead. I was going to say one can identify on different levels. You know, one can identify with the song from the emotion of the melody or the harmonies in it. But one can identify also with the lyric, you know, and then those two put together become very powerful. Very, very powerful.
Yeah, using both. I want to encourage everyone who's listening or later to look you up, find your music, find out what you're doing, and come play with you at a workshop with Building a Vocal Community and see the magic that you do. Watch your TED Talk that you say well. And experience, I think you give an experience in that talk, which is great, by having people sing together, and then when we listen to it, we can sing along. I want to thank you for just that, you know, those gifts that you put out there. Is there anything else you would say to people who come to you and say, oh, I can't sing?
I don't know any people who can't sing.
There you go. And I think that's true. I watch you. You can create the space, that sacred space for anyone to sing. So it's beautiful.
Yeah. I think that person would be really unusual, and I would want to get to know them better. Really, you don't sing? Really? Okay. I try to get people not to be self-absorbed, and that's usually, and I don't want to, you know, embarrass anybody, but you know, people who say, oh, I can't sing, I can't, are people who are kind of self-absorbed and don't see themselves as sharing something that, you know, that is a bit personal. Your voice is personal. Your voice is who you are. And so agreeing to share that, even in a very subtle way, is, you know, is challenging sometimes. But I think the pleasure that one gets out of it is so much greater than the ability to keep it all in. That once you've done it, you want to do it again.
Oh, that's fantastic. Any parting messages for our listeners?
Yeah, find somebody to sing with. Come to get
I love it.
The next community sing in Washington, D.C. is going to be May 31st at the Levine Music. And throughout the year, except June, July, I do a community sing at Levine Music. It's a school of music here in Washington, D.C. But, you know, if you invite me, I'll come and do a community sing with you, too.
I travel. The wheels are turning. So, I want to thank you for joining me today on the show, and Mary Lou, our guest, and all the other guests are going to listen later, and also remind about upcoming study groups in May. I have Kate McKinnon a week from today, Friday, May 12th, going to talk about touch, healing, and presence, and she's going to talk about Compassionate Touch, there's a children's book by Susan Cota who is taking that book into schools and teaching Compassionate Touch. So I think that's beautiful. And then Friday, May 26th, Suzanne Scarlett-Durana is going to talk about Feel the Present Moment and maybe a little bit about her new upcoming book in June. So stay tuned for more things. And you can always go to livingthepresentmoment.com/study group. That's livingthepresentmoment.com/study group. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Isai.
Thank you, Joel. I really, really had a good time.
Yay.
Thank you
both. Hope to have you again.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.